Earth Day, everybody. My name is John Wunderlin. My pronouns are him. Oops.
Hi.
My pronouns are he, him, and his. I've been a member of Prairie for 5 years and currently serve on the board of directors as well as the building committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. During our virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. We will also have joys and concerns during this time. The opening words, did we get Randy in here? We did not. See, anyway, you want to raise your hands to say the opening words or I can do it? Oh, there he is. Sorry. Yep.
The opening words are by Gaylord Nelson. The ultimate test of man's conscience may be his willingness to sacrifice something today for future generations, whose words of thanks will not be heard.
Then our next one, I guess we don't have an opening song this time, so we can go right into the chalice lighting. So, hang on a minute. Let me get you. There you go, Randy.
Okay, chalice lighting today is by Paul Sprecher. We light this chalice for the web of life which sustains us, for the sacred circle of life in which we have our being, for the earth, the sky above and below, and for our Mother Earth, and for the mystery.
Now we'll have a moment of silent meditation. If I can get my screen to work again this time, and my cat stops meowing. Okay. Our story for all ages today is You Are Stardust by Ellen Kelsey, read by The Story Girl. This is another YouTube video. And get it set up here.
Welcome.
Oops. There we go.
Welcome. Today we're going to read a book called You Are Stardust by Ellen Kelsey, and artwork by Seo-Yun Kim. You are stardust. Every tiny atom in your body came from a star that exploded long before you were born. You started life as a single cell. So did all other creatures on planet Earth. Like fish deep in the ocean, you called salt water home. You swam inside the salty sea of your mother's womb. Salt still flows through your veins, your sweat, and your tears. The sea within you is as salty as the ocean. The water swirling in your glass once filled the puddles where dinosaurs drank. From ocean to sky to land and back again, the same water has been quenching thirsts for millions of years. You learn to speak the same way baby birds learn to sing, by chatting with your parents. Mama, ma, tweet, tweet, tweet. Be still. Listen. Like you, the earth breathes. Your breath is alive with the promise of flowers. Each time you blow a kiss to the world, you spread pollen that might grow to be a new plant. Inside your brain, electricity stronger than lightning powers every thought. You sneeze with the force of a tornado. Wind rockets from your nose quicker than a cheetah can sprint. You grow at night when your bones are resting, just like the sheep you count to help you sleep. You may sprout even taller in the spring and summer, just like the plants in your garden. Your hair falls like autumn leaves. You tend to shed the most hair in early autumn and save your thickest growth for the heart of winter. Your body constantly changes. New cells line your stomach every 3 days. You'll replace your skin 100 times by the time you turn 10. Just as old forests grow new trees in place of old ones, you grow entirely new skeletons throughout your life. If you were a planet, you'd be a lot like the Earth. Rainforests on land and algae in the oceans are the Earth's lungs. From your head to your toe, inside and out, billions of teeny microorganisms live on planet you. You know how it feels to be a good friend, and so do other animals. Bats and sperm whales get their friends to babysit. Elephants remain best buddies for life. You, me, birds flying through the rainforest. We're all connected. We're all nature. We're all stardust.
There we go. All right. So our presentation today is The Climate Action Movement Today. Is It Shooting Itself in the Foot or Reaching for the Moon? By Peter Anderson. Peter has been a full-time lifelong environmental activist. In 2011, he joined the first Keystone Pipeline protests and spent 3 days in jail with Bill McKibben, after which he shifted his focus to the climate fight. Take it away, Peter.
Some of you may know my past life as a struggling environmental activist. We had no money, but we had ideals and spent many nights sleeping on the floor of the Capitol. Many of you, though, probably don't know that midlife, thanks to Molly, I started having a family, become a family man, and we now have 4 grown children and 3 grandchildren. And the reason I have that backdrop here is as a prop to help explain the motivation that animates me to take my concern about where the climate movement has been heading in the last 5 years and raise it into a public discussion so we can find out what we need to do to ensure we can preserve a world for our kids, because that's Peachy, our 5-month-old latest grandchild. And I know that Erin and Barb and Judy would disagree, but that is probably one of the cutest babies in the world. And I sure as heck don't want to lose a livable world for her. It's no sense asking people in any prairie meeting. I think most people have already read and know the extremity and the existential situation we confront, and have probably read the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. And if those who haven't read it probably have read the summaries, which are, we have to reduce within 10 years the amount of greenhouse gas emissions we're releasing into the atmosphere to less than half of what they were 10 years ago. And that's just a milestone on the way to getting completely off of all fossil fuels by 2050. And the enormity of that task, our whole modern technological economy depends upon the magic of those very dense fossil fuels. 1 gallon, just 1 gallon of gasoline provides the equivalent amount of work to about 3 months worth of work by a strong man. And we have to completely get off of that in such a short time, according to the IPCC. And most people are shaking in their boots that that's not possible. And what worries me is because of the shortcomings of how the IPCC makes its analysis and the shortcomings on how we evaluate what we hear, the actual situation is even more in extremis than the IPCC says, because what they do to be ultra conservative is they only count things in their analysis for which we have pretty good documented numbers in several peer-reviewed documents to establish what that number is. If we don't have that number, it's excluded as if there is nothing happening. And one of the biggest ones of those unknowns, or as Rumsfeld would say, known unknowns or unknown known unknowns, is the fact that the warming that's going on in the Arctic, as the ice melts and the darker water that replaces the ice absorbs about 6 times more heat than the ice had reflected, is the warming in the Arctic is about twice the warming rate that we're seeing here. It's about 5 degrees. And as a consequence of that, the minimum extent of the Arctic ice in the summer is about half of what it had been when the satellite measurements first started back in 1979. And the old ice, the thick ice that sustains it from melting fast, that is 90% less than it was back in 1979. And the reason why that's so critical is in the permafrost that rims the Arctic, in the Siberia, in Alaska, in the Hudson Bay area of Canada, is in that permafrost there's as much carbon latent, has been frozen there, 3 times as much, 2 to 3 times as much as is in the atmosphere, and that's going to be released. We don't know how fast, but we can see the bubbling methane bubbles today. That's not counted. An enormous contributor is just ignored. The factors that we also have as shortcomings in terms of how we understand this is that there's an enormous lag in between the emissions of greenhouse gas emissions and what we see in our weather around us today because of the inertia of our planet. So what we're seeing today in terms of the extreme weather, in terms of spring arriving 2 weeks earlier and summer leaving 2 weeks later, in terms of what's happening in the Arctic, all that is what's happened because of what happened 30 years ago. 30 years ago, of course, The Simpsons started its run on Fox TV. Nelson Mandela was released from prison. The Berlin Wall was taken down. Tim Berners-Lee published his first paper on this novel concept called the World Wide Web. The Godfather 3 was on TV. And so John doesn't lose interest in this. The space shuttle Discovery placed the Hubble Space Telescope in an orbit around the Earth. And in terms of everything that's happened since that year, 1990, in terms of the emissions that occurred when Super Nintendo came out, hip-hop, Monica Lewinsky, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, BP disaster in the Gulf, the baseball steroid scandal, the Great Recession, the end of the American Idol on TV, and the election of a failed real estate grifter as president of the United States, all the emissions in every one of those years has not yet manifested itself in what we're seeing around us. And lastly, in terms of how shortcomings about what we see, we don't understand that we typically think that if we have a pollution problem and we let it go a little bit too long, we can come in afterwards with a bucket and a mop and clean it up. But carbon dioxide lingers in the atmosphere against the decay processes probably for about 200 years. That's 7 generations more. And that's going to continue no matter what we do today. So when you put all that mix into the pot, in addition to what the IPCC says, we maybe have 5 years to completely turn things ourselves around and get it on an irreversible track that cannot be reversed by some future nutcase president that we happen to elect. Because otherwise, the world that we're going to have for Peachy and for your grandkids and for your kids is not going to be hospitable for human civilization. This is extraordinarily urgent beyond anything we've ever seen before. And what worries me as a climate activist is what I see has happened to us in terms of defining the core strategy of how we intend to turn things around. So I moved from environmental activism to climate activism, as you mentioned in your little introduction, John, back in April of 2011, when I got a personal letter from Bill McKibben, the leader of the climate movement, to me and to 100,000 other of his best friends, saying we had to turn things around, that the first way we had been fighting for climate action, which was inside the Beltline lobbying, was not working. The Waxman-Markey bill, the cap and trade, had failed in the Senate after the environmental movement had spent $350 million to get it passed. And he said, what Bill presently said, is we have to have a workaround to get around the fact that the fossil industry tentacles controlled Washington. We have to get out, build a grassroots movement, and engage in direct action. And the first target he picked was the Keystone Pipeline. And people at that time said, that's insane. It's a greased pig. Nothing's going to stop it. You're a nutcase, McKibben. And we worked and worked and worked. And we beat that thing for a long time until and we actually had a victory with President Obama until the election of Donald Trump. But it was a huge victory. But the reason I'm here talking today about my concern about where we're going is in the last 4 and 5 years, basically from the period of about 2014 to 2016, things completely changed in terms of how the young folks especially started looking at the world. And what basically has happened is that they, especially on the elite college campuses and in the more educated parts of the coastal cities, the priority has been given to social justice, to racial justice, to sexual justice, to racial equality. All of these are wonderful things. All these are things that are being put forward with the best of intentions. But the question I want to put to you is this a strategy that confronts the reality of what America is and has been in the 21st century so that we can win? Now, before I go on and say these heresies, I want to put three predicates here to soften what I want to say. The first thing is, I believe in social justice enormously on a personal level. 20 years ago, I founded Dane Dances, which does multiracial, multi-ethnic dances on the rooftop of Minota Terrace every Friday in the summer. And we started out with 500 people. This last year, we had 5,000 people. And that last night, more than half of them we're Black. We had enormous success in getting people from all walks of life to learn to enjoy each other as people, as opposed to different tribes. I'm a volunteer in many social justice issues. I'm a volunteer teacher in the first grade of Kaleem Care's One City School. I am a volunteer peacemaker with Dane County's Youth Restorative Justice Program, Moses fighting mass incarceration. This is all stuff I believe in my gut. But the question I need to put here, I need to ask everybody, is social justice, while it's important personally for us to pursue, is it a strategy for enacting climate change legislation? And I want to say, the second thing I want to say is, I'm not just a casual observer. I have been on the front lines fighting on environmental issues as a lobbyist, where I started an environmental decade, now Clean Wisconsin, with a major role drafting and passing the power plants, Siting Act, the Wetlands Protection Act, the Mining Reclamation Act, and on. I know how things get done in America as it is. But the most important preface I want to put forward is, because I know I'm sounding pedantic as I go through all this, the last thing I would want to do was speaking to those who are younger than I am, and then generations that followed the baby boom generation, is what I'm saying is, when I was young and when my generation is young, we did the same stupid mistakes that I see being done today. And since I'm going to be dead and my generation will be dead when the worst things occur in terms of climate disasters, but you're going to be here is critical. If we see that the life's lessons learned that we have acquired point to mistakes you're making, and if you don't correct them, the world as we know it is going to be no more. It's critical that we do everything we can to seek to convince you to not make the same screw-ups that we did 50 years ago. The thing that I still remember is marching in the 1967 March on Washington opposing the Vietnam War, where Abby Hoffman, to get some more press attention, he said, we're going to march from the Capitol over to the Pentagon and levitate the Pentagon 300 feet in the air and causing it to vibrate until all the evil emissions have fled. But in consequences of our purity, we said, Hubert Humphrey, who was running for president against Richard Nixon and had been vice president under LBJ, who prosecuted the Vietnam War, he wasn't a pure enough anti-war candidate. And many of our generation said, as I hear many saying today about Joe Biden, I can't vote for that guy. He's not pure enough. And in consequences of our conviction that we had to be pure and youth knew it all, we were effectively elected Richard Nixon. And in the aftermath of electing Richard Nixon to prosecute the war for a number of years, even worse, 22,000 more Americans were killed, 173,000 more North Vietnamese were killed. And in Cambodia, 6 million peasants were murdered in the killing fields, all because of our purity. And so I think to myself, oh, one more thing. And we said, okay, we screwed up then in 1972 after the 68 debacle. We'll elect a pure candidate. And we rushed into the primaries and in the Democratic lefty primaries. We got George McGovern to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. And we knew that youth was going to be able to take and conquer all. And he lost to Richard Nixon in the worst landslide in American history. And Nixon won 49 out of 50 states in the Electoral College. And I think to myself, if I don't seek to bring some reality into this discussion about where and what's wrong with what's happening to the strategy of the climate movement, I'll be derelict to the memory and the importance for me of my granddaughter and of your kids and your granddaughter. So this, let me just point to, I know we don't have too much time, to two things. One is the Green New Deal, which sounds marvelous, but when you open up the hood as to what really is going on, because all it really is not a piece of legislation. It's a statement of aspirations, which is fine, but it's also a political manifesto that says we will not pass climate legislation until we have first linked and passed with it health care for all, guaranteed well-paying jobs, housing for all, free college, and according to many of the supporters, published understandings of what was meant by this, measures that end racism, sex discrimination, income inequality, and even end capitalism. The wonderfulness of what is sought is great, but holding climate action hostage to those completely idealistic goals may not be the very best bet in terms of getting something done. We have to think about this. These wrongs that we have in our in human civilization have been going on for 5,000 years. That's 16,000 generations they persisted. The idea that we're going to end them in the next five, which is all we have, so we can then turn to climate, is a bet that is imprudent and simply makes no sense. The other thing about what's going on in the last 5 years, which has changed completely what was going on in terms of standard politics to reflect the realities of what America is today, is we are constantly framing the reason why people should care about climate change over things about the folks who are the marginalized communities, and the disadvantaged communities, which is a wonderful sentiment. It is a tragedy that by 2050, 15 million peasants in Bangladesh are going to be dislocated by the rising seas. It is an unprecedented human tragedy. Also, it's talked about a tragedy about the disproportionate effects in America in terms of rising seas. But there we have to stretch reality to make that case, because yes, in New Orleans during the Hurricane Katrina, the lower Ninth Ward was flooded, and that was predominantly Black, and that was predominantly poor. But most of the homes on the coastal shores of the United States, where the first impacts of rising seas are going to be felt, are rich mansions of people who are white and quite well off and can afford to buy choice oceanfront landscape land. The other thing to bear in mind is this is America, in which after 100 years of the worst income inequality, and Congress sits down in order to remedy this with a new tax law, and it gives 95% of its benefits to the top 1%. This is what happens in America. The power elites are in control of our world. We may not like it. We may hate it. We may despise it, but that's the reality. And the hardest thing we are confronting to win and get the support of the power elite, and I know many of these people, they are not stupid. They know climate change is coming, but they think their money will enable them to insulate the world from their kids, and they can make a safe harbor for their kids, buy an island if necessary to protect themselves. The whole reason, the biggest reason why we cannot get progress is that the rich and powerful and the 1% think they can insulate themselves with their money. When they can't, when the world of the civilization crumbles, they can't. And what are we saying to them? Not that you're going to be involved and you're going to be injured too. We're saying it's only the poor we have to worry about. It's a far more effective story, if we want to win, to talk about Kim Kardashian and Cyrus, Miley Cyrus's mansions in Beverly Hills, which were burned down. They almost ran for their lives in 2018 due to the Woolsey fire. But we talk about only the people who don't. The one thing I keep on thinking about in my life, I spent a lot of time fighting for helping to defend frontline communities, many from landfills. And we thought when we started, these landfills will leak. Here's the proof, they will leak. We just have to educate the public that landfills will leak, and this travesty against frontline communities will be stopped in its tracks. And for 20 years, we spent time over and over again. Finally, it dawned on me after getting from nowhere for 20 years, people didn't give a damn. They said to themselves, thank God it's going over there, because if the landfill's going over there where they're complaining, it has to go somewhere. It means it's not going to be in my backyard. Thank God it's in their backyard. This is America. This is the way things are. And if we don't learn to find strategies that work with America as it is, I'm going to lose a future world for my granddaughter, and you're going to lose a future world for your kids. So the purpose of coming here on Earth Day is not meant to be critical. It's meant to be like that little child in my namesake in that fable who said the emperor, in this case, the strategy based upon nobility and social justice, the emperor has no clothes in America as it is. In a world, in a country where Trump, someone like Donald Trump can be elected, basing a strategy that depends upon a revolution makes no sense. The only time America ever came even close to a revolution was in 1893, 125 or so years ago, after the 1893 Depression, the worst depression this country had ever faced, when it was economic devastation beyond comprehension. And even then, we lost and didn't have a revolution. So to bet on a revolution, like Bernie was betting on an upswing, a huge upturn in the youth turnout, belies the world that we live in. I don't believe that we can rely upon a strategy that's going to levitate and overturn the 1% and bring social justice any more than Abby Hoffman was able to levitate the Pentagon back in 1967. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. So let's do some discussion on this. I will raise your hand either through video or virtually, and I will unmute you so we don't have everybody talking at once. And I'll leave Peter unmuted just to warn you, Peter.
Okay.
Mary, go ahead.
Well, since we haven't been able to do much about this for 30 years, how can we do it in 5? I guess that's my question.
Well, I mean, to be quite frank, Mayor, I'm not optimistic. I just can't not try. I'm 73. I know I'm crowding on you, but it's not me. So much of our generation, people are spending their money on redecorating the kitchen for 50 more than people usually spend on a house. I can't spend the rest of my year, my short years left, redecorating my kitchen. I'm going to do everything I can to try and hope we can pull it out. But I do know this: if we don't have a strategy that's going to have any chance to win at all, we cannot continue this, in my view. And I respect that people who I know, respect and love, and are reasonable people feel the opposite. This is a thing about which there's no simple answer. But I just know that if we don't go in a track that has a chance of success, we'll have no ability and no capacity to save a future world for Patty's grandkids.
Well, so then I had a follow-up. It sounds like you were saying earlier that it's the 1% that really need to be convinced, and then that might be the strategy to use.
Yeah, that's one key part of it. It's not the only part, but yes, if whatever strategies you have, and it has to be a multifaceted strategy, a piece of it has to be direct action, a piece of it has to be working with the economics, but one piece of it that's critical is absolutely critical, is if the rich don't think that they're in it with the same boat we are, in the country, this country as it is, we don't stand a chance. That's one key part of it, yes. And I don't think we further that goal by saying it's all about poor people and marginalized people. We just feed into their perception, their misperception. And to be exactly precise, money will allow them to insulate themselves for one or two more years, but not for a lifetime. When you look at the collapses of the civilization that occurred after the bubonic plague and so on, civilization is a very thin veneer. The strength of us as civilization comes from networking. It all falls apart once the comity between the various players no longer has trust to sustain it. So that just look at Germany in 19. I mean, who would have thought that Trump could be elected here in America during a time of not a depression period? It's just civilization does not have much fiber to sustain it. So yes, back to your question. One critical piece is to make the rich understand that they're in the same boat as everyone else.
Well, maybe when their houses are destroyed, the ones that are out on the barrier islands and so on, or next to them, some begin to realize this.
So all our stories are about the poor and marginalized. I'm saying I want more stories about the rich with their mansions and Kim Kardashian with her mansions and the fires and the flooding. We have lots of the stories that ultimately, by repetition, ultimately permeates into their mindset.
Anybody else? I've got something, but I'll wait. I'll take my turn last. Go ahead, Barb.
I was reading about, I can't remember which city, but one of the coastal cities where the rich and famous knew they needed to move because they were all on the coast. So they were buying up the inner city and displacing the same poor folks that had been forced to live in the inner city when it wasn't the place to be. So
gentrification in different forms, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Although I've got to agree with you in the sense, Peter, that every year as the grannies go around and say, everybody says, what is their priority for that year in terms of, you know, what we sing and stuff. And mine always is climate change because they say, you know, unless we deal with that, nothing else matters. We won't be here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to unmute you, Penny.
I've got it muted.
There you go. Go ahead.
Yeah, nothing. But it all feeds into climate change. War matters because conducting wars is a terrible climate contributor. And you got to wonder if something like the COVID virus is Mother Nature's way of taking care of it, except for she's taking the old, which we're going to go anyway, and leaving the young. And if Mother Nature were really efficient, she'd take everybody.
Well, that's one way. Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that, Penny. Yeah.
Well, so Peter, I wanted to ask about the, you know, you were talking about the Green New Deal being, it's kind of my way or the highway type thing that says we're not going to do anything until we get everything. I mean, obviously, you know, and I've been futilely trying to convince some Bernie backers on Facebook to get over it and move on, because we can't afford 4 more years of Trump. But you had talked about, and I wasn't quite sure what you were getting at. You were talking about some, you know, about the social justice issues. It seems to me like we can still address some social justice issues while also focusing on climate change, right? I wasn't quite clear on where you were going with that.
There are some issues that do fit in and may be doable and are in fact being pursued. The first one is, in terms of the carbon tax, is that this is to meet the problem that half of our country doesn't believe in government. And to say that we'll collect the carbon tax to put a price on carbon, like the gasoline you buy in your car, but we'll give back all that money. We won't have one penny kept by the government on a per capita basis. And by giving it money back on a per capita basis, remembering the bottom 30% or so pays no taxes. On a per capita basis, that's a very strong income redistribution. But saying giving it back on a per capita basis is a very political thing to say. And that can work. The second thing that I think can work is to say, when you have efforts made to mitigate climate change in terms of moving houses from flooding rivers or the coast, you can say that the monies have to be given equally to poor as well as rich communities and not just to rich. I think a very strong, that can fit in with the way you can shame people in America, even in America as corrupt as it is. But to go on and say we have to have justice for a Black discrimination, for sexual discrimination, for transgender discrimination, Medicare for all, that's what they're saying. I didn't think I had time, but let me give you an example why that's what's going on. Washington State is one of the most liberal states in the country. And in 2016, groups which were just focused on climate said we should have a referendum, because they have referendums there where you can have things passed by a popular vote. And it was I-732 as the referendum that said carbon tax, all the money goes back to the people per capita. And the social justice folks came out and said, that's not good enough. We've had too much injustice all these years with government austerity, and we have to use that tax money to bring back the dollars that had been taken with austerity takebacks in the years prior for programs for health and well-being for poor people in marginalized communities. And the people with the trying to get the ordinance passed, so we got to get this through. Climate is, we don't have a livable climate, nothing's going to happen. And the social justice groups and the environmental groups and the labor groups joined together and opposed the carbon tax and defeated it. And so they said, okay, they're going to come back in 2 years. In 2018, they came back with a bill that did not just redistribute it back, but gave the taxes collected from the carbon tax back to the various social justice issues and some for renewable power. And it went down, it failed by 13 points. And that's an example, one of the, I think, thank you for the question, to concretize what's made me so dismayed that, but it illustrates what actually is tangibly going on. So these folks feel so committed to social justice, they feel everything else to be held back until they get the social justice first. Now, many of these people are just very sincere and are very driven by the issues. Others are the, I remember back in after the Three Mile Island accident in 79, there are these Trotsky groups and stuff, which are always looking for angles. And they come in, they want the most extreme things passed that are not passable in the US, and they try and exploit the situation. And I think what you had probably is a mixture of both kind of folks going into that situation, which became toxic for climate action. But the reality is, when you look at what's going on, what the Green New Deal is, underneath all this wonderful rubric about how important climate is and how important action is to take it, is holding climate hostage until we get social justice. And if they think they're going to get social justice through in the 5 years we have remaining, I just don't know what's going on. Watching my own folks, my colleagues, my comrade in arms, we run into the same confirmation. We exhibit the same confirmation bias. We take incantations and we just repeat them without thinking about them in the same way, to a certain extent, as the right wing. And we have to learn the limitations of how our minds work and don't work if we're going to overcome those impediments that keep us from making rational decisions about what's viable and what's doable in this country as it is.
Thanks. See, Randy, I think I saw you had your hand up there for a minute, and looks like you've got two devices active. So, yeah, I think this probably has to be the last one. Then we need to move on. But, oops, I can't hear you. Wait a minute. Let me swap your mutes here. Try it now.
Maybe Peter, you could share with us some specific legislative actions that might lead toward the goals that you see versus the Green New Deal and the carbon tax?
Well, I think let me try and answer it this way, Randy, is if we lose in November, I mean, all hope is gone. So the first thing to get to that, before you even reach that, is how do we not lose this election? And in that regard, the same kind of problem arises. So some of the folks like this believe that we should just rise up and kind of win the election based upon the demographic wave of this, the country's becoming less white and more diverse over time. And we should not try to recapture the liberal white voters who voted twice for Obama and then switched to Trump. We should just write them off. We should write off the Republican women, college-educated women. We should just get on that demographic wave in youth. The problem is, that's exactly what we tried to do in 2016 and we lost. And the other complication with that identity politics that's driving this is that more than half of the Black population is opposed to gay marriage. More than half of the Hispanic community is opposed to abortion. This idea that a diverse population equals far left politics does not compute when you look at the actual thing. It's another, in my estimation, delusion. So before I get to your question, if we don't win this election by reaching out both to get the youth engaged and to recapture the Obama Trump switchers and the Republican, we don't try to get all of them and not just count again on a demographic wave, which we keep on losing, we lose the White House and to Trump, we're over. But the point back to your precise question, if we get the White House back, I think it's going to have to be multifaceted. Having a Democratic president does not equate to a smooth glide path to win. It's the fossil fuel industry will switch the money. The Democratic Party has many people who are very susceptible to that. So direct action, grassroots direct action, like Bill McKibben started doing back in 2011, ever so successfully, is another key element. We also have to have regulations like Obama had with cars and autos. But the biggest thing in my mind to actually win is not political and it's not technological. It's changing the mindset of America. There's two mindsets about how you address this crisis. One is the barn raisings that we used to have on the Great Plains back 100, 150 years ago, where everyone got together and helped people, the new family, all together raise the barns together to start a new family on the plains. And the other approach is like the Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Lifeboat. We're all this one against the other. And if we don't change America's mindset from the lifeboat mentality to the barn raising mentality, I am very dubious that we have a chance to win. And that there's a group called One Wisconsin in Milwaukee is very much working to develop this idea of the sense of community. And I know it sounds amorphous, but in terms of what I've watched in my 50 years as being an activist and a political player, things that are the deep embedded as to what kind of people we are in our gut are so important. And although I keep on harping about how so much of our psychology is not pretty in terms of how we act selfishly, look at India. I look at India and you compare what was brought out by Gandhi 60 years ago and then what's completely reversed that by Modi, the new president and premier in India. Under the right conditions and the right leadership, you can bring out the good in people, at least for a short period of time. And if we don't do that, the whole equation we discussed about president, direct action, regulations, and also I forgot to mention economics, working on what convincing the people who have investment money where you're going to lose money in fossil fuels. Unless we have that underlying sense of community, we're not going to have a chance, because I believe, and this is another controverted statement, that those who say it's very simple to go all renewables and you just turn a switch and make a political decision and it costs no more, that's not true. The amount of energy we demanded by, especially by the third world, to rise up to middle class standards is not going to be easily met unless we are willing to say we're going to use less. So it does not mean anyone has to go back and live in a cave, but it does mean to make it all work and provide room for the undeveloped world to get livable conditions that are of a middle-class life for the undeveloped world. It means we all have to live simpler lives. And that again feeds into the whole point of meeting a sense of community.
Thanks a lot, Peter. I think we've got to jump ahead here, and we might have time for more discussion after we're all done here. So the next part of the service is the offering. If you feel like going and contributing a few dollars. The link is, I sent the order of service out. The link to Prairie's offering site is right in the order of service. And we're going to next play this piece that Carl and Paula put together on YouTube. And hopefully my screen share works this time.
This is the one that they did. It's really good. Oh, you saw it, didn't you? You saw part of it? So the next thing in our program is the closing song, which is another song back to back. Oops, I got my darn YouTube keeps restarting the next video in my list. Blue Boat Home by Peter Mayer. And I need to share. Thank you.
sharing the video.
Oops, sorry. Got too many screens here. All right, and our closing words are by Gaylord Nelson. Randy's back.
I'm back. Our goal is not just an environment of clean air and water and scenic beauty. The objective is an environment of decency, quality, and mutual respect for all other human beings and all other living creatures.